They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Calls are growing louder for more funding to help developing countries fight climate change. But how much more? Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Poorer nations need more than $2 trillion each year for the next 8 years to tackle the impact of a changing climate. That is the conclusion of the UN-backed Finance for Climate Action report. It's presented at the COP27 summit in Egypt, and it says half of the funding should collectively come from individual governments and institutions, while the other half should come from rich nations, investors, and multilateral development banks. Those are organizations which provide financial support to developing nations. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is one such organization. It was set up by China in 2016 as an alternative to the World Bank. It now has the second highest membership globally, including the UK and Italy. Sir Danny Alexander, its vice president of policy and strategy, explains how they're trying to help finance a global green transition.
Climate finance is about both mitigation, things like renewable energy, but also about adaptation and resilience. And we see adaptation and resilience as crucially important. We've been, for example, investing in waste management in the Maldives to help protect their local environment. But of course, to protect that country more broadly requires global action to reduce carbon emissions. So AIB is also investing in large-scale solar power here in Egypt, for example. We're investing in wind power, in other forms of renewable energy to support that broader climate transition.
Have you run into any difficulties in meeting some of those targets?
There are a vast array of difficulties. As with every large-scale project, you have to make sure the project is implemented on the ground. You know, you have to sometimes work with governments around the regulatory regime that is there to make sure that the project can deliver at the scale and volume that is needed. The biggest challenge is just how do we get the volume of projects and the volume of money to finance those projects at the scale that is needed to finance this transition. The kind of good message from this COP is that there is a huge amount of effort globally, not just from international institutions like ours, but also from countries, from governments, and from the private sector to make that happen.
One of the big themes that's really emerging from this year's COP conference is that those countries that pollute the most should pay the most. And that's going to be one of the, I think, more controversial conversations that happen there. I just wonder, in the projects that you guys have been working on, do you see that those countries that have been affected by climate change and sort of feel as though they've been left behind, do you find that they're wholly on board to sort of explore and invest and rely on those greener technologies first and not want to lean more toward the more polluting industries and technologies?
And many of those countries, they have a huge need for development. And if that can be delivered through renewable energy, then I think that what we see is those countries embracing that as an alternative. And I think you're right that developing countries have an opportunity to leapfrog to the best technology and the cleanest technology. And I think a role for multilateral institutions like ours is to help them do so.
Sir Danny Alexander, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Checking the numbers now, stock benchmarks across Europe are struggling for direction at this hour. That's as investors await the outcome of the U.S. midterm elections and the latest American consumer price data due this morning. In Asia, Hong Kong's Hang Seng and the Shanghai Composite Index slipped in the 0.2% to 0.4% range. That's after an unexpectedly strong surge in COVID-19 cases in China and after weaker than expected trade data yesterday showed a contraction in exports and imports last month. Britain is in the midst of its worst ever outbreak of the bird flu, and that is creating a nightmare before Christmas for poultry farmers and their customers. Tough new restrictions to fight the disease have been introduced across England this week. They require all captive birds to be kept indoors. The BBC's Jack Kyla has more from Somerset in the southwest of England.
These are difficult times for those in the poultry industry. Since October last year, more than 5 million birds have been culled nationally as a result of avian flu. The disease circulates naturally in wild birds that can spread the flu to poultry and captive birds when they migrate to the UK. Simon Barton is from the NFU's Poultry Board.
It's a very nervous time for poultry producers across the southwest with avian flu in the run-up to Christmas. We're all just hoping it stays out of the sheds and we can produce the product for the consumer. Normally in the summer we see the disease falling away, but this year it didn't. The avian influenza this year has been the worst we've ever seen, way above levels we've seen before, and now the housing order has come into this part of the country because the risk level has increased.
The government has said everyone must keep their birds inside. That's regardless of the type of bird or the numbers kept. So that's everything from a couple of chickens in your garden to thousands in a barn. We've been warned all this could have an impact on the cost of how much we pay for poultry, particularly looking ahead to turkeys this Christmas. George Ford is a turkey farmer in Somerset.
Turkeys are really vulnerable, and if you see a couple dead one day, then the next day or 2 days it could all be gone. So it definitely helps. What they've changed now is as soon as there's a report of bird flu on your farm, so if you sent off the bird, had it examined or post-mortemed, and if they confirm there's a case, they will then compensate from that point. But it just depends how long it takes for the bird to get to the lab, to get tested, you know, all that time. You're losing birds because it's just so contagious. So compensation doesn't take the stress away. I don't really see it as a lifeline of saviour, if that makes sense.
But what about the wild birds and the impact on them? With hundreds of thousands of birds migrating in and out of the country, what impact is this having on our native species? And what can be done to cut down cases? I've been speaking to Dr. Christine Middlemiss, the UK's chief veterinary officer.
For the first time ever, the virus has stayed with us over the summer. Normally it dies off, it stayed in our seabirds. They're moving around now as it's got colder, and that's brought the virus inland there. So it's in our native wild birds. What we're looking very hard at the moment too is what's happening in our migratory returning birds. That's our usual risk, and it's when they start to come back, just as they are doing now. We're watching very closely to see what's happening with them if they're bringing virus back with them too. And that might be for the southwest if they do bring new virus when we start to see an uptick.
With regards to the wild birds themselves, what will eventually stop this happening, or are you essentially waiting now for it to disappear naturally?
That they'll become immune as long as the virus stays reasonably much the same. It doesn't change too much. We expect them to become immune, and then that will mean that the strain of the virus dies out. The concern is always the migratory birds go to the north of Russia over the summer. They mingle with other birds and other flyways that may have come from Asia and Africa. They might bring slightly different strains of the virus. It's about how they all mix together. We do know this strain, this H5N1 we're seeing, is a very dominant, what we call a very fit virus, and in effect is knocking out the others. That is a good thing for immunity of the birds, and that's the one they'll meet, and that's the one they will become immune to eventually.
And I suppose the big question now for farmers and for anyone else who's keeping poultry is, how long do you think these restrictions will stay in place?
It's really difficult to say at the moment. I would expect over the winter months, it depends on A, the migratory birds, as I said, and B, how quickly immunity develops in our own native birds.
That's the UK's chief veterinary officer, Dr. Christine Middlemiss, ending that report from the BBC's Jack Kyla in Somerset. And in London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.